Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 20 of The Master Mystery. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Master Mystery by John W. Gray and Arthur B. Reeve. Chapter 20. Darkness had settled down upon Brent Rock, following the departure of Locke, when a trim runabout drew up under the porte-cochere, and Doris stepped lightly out of it. She paused for a moment and looked about curiously. For some time she hesitated. In this house lived the girl whom in her heart Dora hated bitterly. What sort of reception might she expect? Yet Paul and his underworldlings had played on Dora's pride until they had prevailed on her to undertake the mission. As she looked about, all her old assurance came back to her, and Dora turned and approached the door boldly. Eva was just about to go upstairs to her room when she heard the butler at the door and a woman's voice asking whether Miss Brent was at home. Eva paused a moment. There was evidently a slight altercation between the butler and the newcomer as the latter raised her voice sharply.
"You will tell Miss Brent I must see her," reiterated Dora.
There was a pause, during which the butler was heard to murmur something, and then the woman's voice was heard again.
"Tell Miss Brent that if she refuses to see me, she will regret it all her life."
Eva was intensely interested now, for she recognized the voice of Deluxe Dora. But with her interest there came a feeling of repulsion with which this woman always inspired her, and her first impulse was to have Dora shown out of the house. The very nature of the danger with which they were all surrounded, however, prohibited such a drastic course. Yet how dare that woman enter Brent Rock? Still, the very fact of her so daring pointed to some serious matter which Eva felt she ought to know. At any rate, there could be no harm to listen to Dora's reason for coming, and there would probably be much to be learned. Eva called to the butler, and he stepped aside, and Dora, all smiles now, and with her hand extended in greeting, advanced toward Eva, who ignored her extended hand.
"Need I tell you," remarked Eva coldly, "that I am astounded at your presumption in coming here?" "Miss Brent," replied Dora, "believe me, nothing but my present mission could have induced me to do so. There are wheels within wheels which have made it appear that I am your enemy. But that is far from being the truth, as my present mission to you will prove."
Dora was clever, and played her cards cleverly. However, Eva was on guard.
"Please come to the point," she insisted. "Tell me exactly why you have come."
Dora paused a moment, then replied impressively,
"I have come to save your father's life."
Eva caught herself almost gasping in astonishment as Dora covertly watched the effect of her words.
"You have the antidote, then?" asked Eva breathlessly. "Not exactly that," replied Dora quickly. "But I can take you where you can obtain it. A man has arrived from Madagascar who has it in his possession." "What shall I do?"
almost wailed the poor girl.
"How can I know that you speak the truth?"
Dora's voice now assumed a cold decisiveness.
"That is for you to decide," she said merely. "Refuse to come with me, and your father will surely die of his madness. Consent, and he may live."
Eva could hesitate no longer. Bidding Dora wait, she ran up the stairs, returning in a few moments garbed for the street. They left the house together, but not before the butler had surreptitiously slipped a large automatic into Eva's handbag. In the Chinese temple, or Joss House, the last devotee had departed. The hanging lights had been dimmed, and now the fantastic shapes with which the place was decorated, seen in the subdued light, stood out in all their shadowy weirdness. From the raised dais, the seven-handed god assumed an added majesty and awfulness, while, deep-seated as though from a smoldering cauldron, two points of fire gleamed from the god's eyes with utmost malevolence. Slowly a panel in the wall slid back, and the bestial visage of the strangler peered out. After making sure that there was no one about, with noiseless tread he glided into the temple. Like a shadow, a second figure, that of a Chinaman, followed him. The two made a complete circuit of the temple, stopping now and again to examine some object which arrested their attention. Then, as if by a prearranged signal, they both prostrated themselves before the fire god. After making many obeisances, they got to their feet and, as mysteriously as they entered, slipped away in the same manner that they had come. A panel closed behind them, but not the same panel. The inner room in which they now found themselves was divided by a partition that extended a few feet out into the temple room itself. This room was vividly painted with weird figures depicting Chinese forms of torture, a veritable charnel house of what in Europe would be called the Dark Ages. There were plenty of evidences that at no very distant date this chamber had been in use to punish horribly those who had offended against the fire god or the commands of the Tong leaders. On one side of the partition was a large iron wheel to which was attached a rope extending through the partition and forming a loop or noose on the other side. The purpose of this device was only too apparent. Once the neck of a victim was in the noose, a few turns of the wheel, the noose would tighten, and the victim would be inevitably strangled to death. In a slightly changed form, it was the garroting machine of old Spain. The strangler tested the rope, twisted the wheel, while his companion occupied himself by watching the effect of the wheel on the noose on the other side of the partition. Apparently satisfied that the machine was in good working order, the Madagascan straightened up and waved his companion out of the room. The Chinaman returned by means of the sliding panel into the temple again. As she left Brent Rock behind, Eva's fears increased. Speeding through the night with this woman whom she instinctively dreaded, whom she had every reason to distrust, many times on the trip Eva wished herself back at her home. On the other hand, to remain inactive while there was a chance to save her father's life was unthinkable. And so, for his sake, she kept on, and the car sped ahead. Dora, on the contrary, anxious to allay Eva's fears, was very voluble, expressing many sentiments which, even to a young girl of little worldly experience, were palpably at variance with the woman's character. In and out of the narrow streets of the city's lower quarter, the car twisted and turned, and at last entered gaily decked Chinatown, where it came to a halt. If Eva was afraid before, she was now doubly so. The strange Oriental faces which seemed to leer at her from street and curb seemed to be almost of another world, and she thought of the many tales she had heard of their treachery and cunning. Dora, sensing what was passing through her mind, kept up a patter of small talk as she urged Eva forward. By another entrance than the one that led through the Chinese curio shop, they entered the Joss House and came to the worshipping room of the temple. Eva gazed fearfully about her now at all the fantastic decorations with which she was surrounded. Her only comfort was the handle of the automatic that the butler had pressed on her as she was leaving home.
"This Madagascan with the antidote," asked Eva tremulously, "where is he?" "Don't worry, dearie," quieted Dora. "Wait a moment here, and I will bring him."
Dora turned on her heel and left the temple by the door leading into the beautiful lounging-room beyond. Eva stood transfixed by the solemn awfulness of the place and the grim visage of the fire-god. Why had she been brought to such a place? What new terrors awaited her here? She seemed alone, yet was she? She felt a thousand eyes regarding her, as though a thousand dangers lurked to destroy her just beyond those fearful walls. She was staring now at the god. What made his eyes gleam so banefully? She thought she heard a sound. Was the wall at the right of the statue moving, or was it merely her heightened imagination? Fascinated, she watched. Yes, she was sure now. Slowly, slowly, a portion of that wall was actually sliding back. Now she saw a hand. Then an arm followed. With a slow, gliding movement that even to Eva's strained ears was noiseless, a man, his back toward her, slid into the room. Eva, shrinking back, wanted to shriek. But instead she whipped out the automatic and in an instant had the man covered. The man was still evidently unconscious of her presence. But suddenly he must have heard Eva move, for he wheeled around, and instinctively his hands went above his head. As for Eva, the cry that she had suppressed at his appearance was suppressed no longer, for the man whom she held at her mercy was Locke!
"How did you come here?" gasped Eva.
Hurriedly he told her his story, how he felt that the clue that he would lead to the unraveling of this mystery was now to be found in Chinatown, how he had made his way, therefore, to the Chinese quarter, how he had tracked the Madagascan. Knowing the futility of trying to enter any private place of the Orientals, much less their temple, in Occidental garb, he had waylaid a Chinaman in an alley, had stripped him, and had changed clothes with him. Disguised thus, Locke had managed to enter, to observe, and was only now on his way to summon assistance. For he had decided to have the place raided. Only now he was stricken almost dumb with astonishment at being confronted by Eva. There was no time for more. Before Eva could explain her own presence there, the door burst open, the panels slid back, and a horde of emissaries and Chinamen swarmed about them. Eva fired her automatic again and again, but could not stay the rush. Locke fought with the courage of despair, but they were too many and soon bore him down. As they carried Locke into the chamber of torture, the last thing he saw was Eva surrounded by her foes who were closing in on the poor girl. Towering above them all, he saw the gigantic form of the automaton. In the torture chamber, Locke was shackled hand and foot to the partition, while the noose of the garroting machine was placed about his neck. The Madagascan supervised this work, then waved the emissaries out of the room. They were alone there now, these two, the professional murderer and his victim. With a sneer, the Madagascan turned and went to the other side of the partition, where the wheel was by which the noose was tightened, strangling the victim. But the strangler little knew with whom he had to deal, for already Locke was struggling at his shackles. With almost incredible dexterity, Locke succeeded in loosening them, one after the other, so that as the Madagascan started to turn the wheel, Locke, with a marvelous effort, bracing his feet against the wall and grasping the staples to which the shackles had been attached, managed to pinwheel his body around and around as the strangler turned the iron wheel that tightened the noose which was to stifle out his life. Fortunately, the Madagascan turned slowly, so that Locke managed to turn his body faster than the wheel was being turned, thus gaining on the noose and at each revolution loosening it a trifle. Another quick turn of his body, the pressure against his neck had become less. Yet another complete circle, and tearing at the noose, he managed to get his head free. It was the work of only an instant to dash around the partition and beat the strangler to the floor. Another instant, and he had torn back the panel into the temple. The sight that confronted him was sickening. Two fiends were holding Eva close to the floor, while now from the fire god's eyes a blinding glare of flame blazed forth, the two rays converging and scorching the very ground as they traveled slowly nearer and nearer in their fatal focus to the helpless girl. With a wild shout, Locke charged on them all. Taken by surprise, the brutes holding Eva were easy to handle, for the others had gone. Fortunately, the automatic which Eva had been carrying was lying, neglected, on the floor. Locke snatched it up, and shooting one of the thugs, managed to cover the other. Half-supporting Eva, he retreated through the torture chamber into an outer room. There was no time to lose. Already the alarm had been spread to the other emissaries and Chinamen, and it was only a matter of seconds when all the murderous crew would again be piling after them. Locke looked about in desperation. There was a window. He flung it open. Below, the air shaft or court was blind. But there was a balcony by which he could reach an adjoining low roof. He had no idea where it might lead, but any unknown danger was preferable to the known dangers that threatened behind him. Through the window he passed with Eva, and so across balconies and roofs until they came to a fire escape, which they descended. In another moment they were free of Chinatown. Many a curious glance was cast at them, a young girl, well-gowned, and a disheveled white man in Chinese garb. Locke hailed a Nighthawk cabman, and they were soon speeding on their way back to safety and Brent Rock. End of Chapter 20. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 21 of The Master Mystery. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Master Mystery by John W. Gray and Arthur B. Reeve. Chapter 21. At the Cove fishing village, set on the extreme outskirts of the town, there stood an old fisherman's shack that was shunned by all the good folk of the city. While there was nothing definite that could be said of the evil deeds of the inhabitants, there was much shaking of heads and wagging of tongues to the effect that all was not as it should be at the Cove. The owner of the old shack, Old Tom, was an ill-favored, taciturn man who would have naught to do with any of his neighbors, and asked only that they keep out of his path and leave him alone. He even evinced an aversion to dogs and to little children, driving them away from his shack whenever he found them near it. The threat that "Old Tom will catch you" would make a Cove fishing village tractable at any time. Old Tom rarely put to sea, and when he did, it was more often than not after nightfall, a time when the good folk of the village were preparing for a night's rest. It was stated by one old crony that often at night other men came to old Tom's shack, that they entered slyly, and that well into the morning revelry, and often oaths and brawls, could be heard from within. Some hinted that old Tom was a smuggler, others even that he was a wrecker. True it was that often strange lights were seen to flicker outside the bar to the cove. Also there had been wrecks, and often in the morning, when the fishermen put out to a wreck after a storm, it would be discovered that someone had been there before them, since valuable and readily portable parts of the wreck were frequently missing. But while suspicion pointed to old Tom and the strange men that frequented his place, proofs positive of a crime were invariably lacking, and so the village tolerated old Tom's presence and predicted his bad end. It was to this shack that there came very early one morning, before the break of day, a wounded man assisted by a woman. The woman gave a peculiar rap at the door. There was a quick scurry inside, as of fast-moving feet, then silence. The woman rapped again, and this time with more force. After a moment a sash was raised, and a querulous voice demanded what was wanted.
"It's Deluxe Dora and Paul Balcom, and he's wounded. Quick, open the door!"
There was a rush to open the door now, and rough hands gently assisted the wounded man to a seat inside. While Paul was not perhaps so dangerously wounded, yet it was easy to be seen that the wound was not to be trifled with, for the cut had been severe, and the blood flowed copiously. Dora, whatever her attitude toward others, had a true solicitude for Paul, and all the womanliness of her nature came to the surface as she tenderly bathed Paul's head and attempted to bind the wound with the rough bandages at hand. There were several tough-looking men standing about, and from their ready sympathy, real or feigned, it was easy to be seen that these men, too, like the others of the underworld, stood ready to do Paul's slightest bidding, to guard him with their lives if need be. What was this strange power that this man, scarcely more than a youth, wielded over these outlawed men?
"Quick!" exclaimed Dora. "Watch the window. We've probably been followed."
A grim-visaged man moved lumberingly over to the window and glued his head against the pane, straining his eyes as he peered out. For a long time he did not move, while, with the others grouped around, Dora tried to staunch the flow of blood from Paul's injured head. Suddenly the watcher at the window turned and shouted, "Man, coming up the lane!" Instantly there was confusion within the shack. The men scattered in all directions, while one old hag, the only woman in the shack besides Dora, hobbled over to a stool and took up the mending of a huge net where she had left off. Old Tom ambled over to Dora, and for a moment they talked hurriedly. Finally Dora came to a decision as she pointed to the old rickety stairway to an attic above.
"Carry him to the attic," she directed. "He can be well hidden there. As for the rest of you, remember, no one has come here tonight."
Two of the men lifted Paul, who, while not in an absolutely unconscious condition, was much too weak by this time from loss of blood to assist himself. They carried him up the stairs and into an old, disused room to which Dora followed, and when the two men had descended the stairs she remained, alternately ministering to Paul and listening for what might happen below. Paul and Dora had left the main room of the shack not a moment too soon, for barely had the two men who had carried Paul to the attic returned when a face was momentarily seen outside, while a pair of eyes peered into the room. A moment later there was a peremptory knock at the door.
"Come in,"
growled old Tom.
With eyes that scanned every cranny and nook and searched every face, Locke stepped into the shack. The men came forward a step, then halted. There was something in Locke's face that showed that he was in deadly earnest and not to be trifled with. Locke looked from one to the other, then turned to old Tom.
"The wounded man who was brought here," he demanded. "Where is he?"
"There ain't been no wounded man brought here," retorted old Tom.
The men crowded a little closer, all denying vehemently that anyone had entered. At this instant a drop of blood fell on Locke's sleeve from the ceiling above. Quickly he checked the impulse to look up, although he was startled by it. He recovered himself on the instant, and waited until, under a pretext, he could divert their attention to something else. Then he glanced hastily upward as they looked in another direction. There, forming slowly, was another drop of blood, and it was about to fall. Locke had gained his object. As surely as though he had been brought face to face with Paul, he knew that he was lying on the floor of the attic above. Single-handed, against so many and in this shack, Locke realized that he could do nothing. He apologized gruffly for his intrusion, conveying the impression that he felt he had made a mistake, and backed his way to the door. In an instant the door to the attic stairs was flung open, and Dora rushed into the room.
"You fools!"
she snarled at the surprised men who were just congratulating themselves on how they had put one over on Locke.
"I tell you, he's wise. He saw the blood. Look, up above you. Now, go get him."
But the fisherman had no desire for this outside work, and hung back, while Dora raved at them. From the ceiling, drop by drop, blood was falling, forming a little pool on the floor. Paul could not be moved now. They must make the best of it and be ready for any raid Locke might prepare. At Brent Rock, Eva was conversing with her lawyer. Matters had reached such a state in the affairs of international patents that it was evident, even to her, that some drastic action must be taken, and at once. In a corner of the room, coiled up in a big armchair, Zita was apparently reading a new magazine, but was in reality listening intently to every word that was being uttered. Finally, Eva and the lawyer were in full accord, and she accompanied the elderly attorney to the door. As they parted, Zita strained her ears to hear the last words. She did not get it all, but quite enough to tell her what they had decided upon.
"As my lawyer," she overheard Eva say, "I wish you to have Mr. Locke appointed receiver."
There was some more she missed, but that was quite enough for Zita. She got out of the chair quickly and left the room without being observed, and a few moments later she had left the house. In a telephone booth, not far from the Cove fishing village, Locke by this time had his chief of the Department of Justice on the wire.
"I've located him, chief," he telephoned excitedly, "but it will take four good men to capture him."
"I'll send them at once,"
the chief replied, as both hung up their receivers hurriedly. Meanwhile, in Herbert Balcom's sumptuous, semi-oriental apartment, two men were in earnest conversation. One was the owner, Balcom. The other, that strange, half-demented being, Dr. Q, whose mind now, for the moment, seemed to be lucid. The matter under discussion was undoubtedly a weighty one, for both men sat with knitted brows, and for the moment, at least, seemed in a quandary about something. Suddenly there came a hurried ringing at the outside doorbell, and Balcom leaped to his feet. They could hear the door opened, quick footsteps in the hallway, and then, without ceremony, the door was flung open, and Dora burst into the room. Balcom scowled a welcome, for he hated this woman, who had, as he thought, spoiled the chances of his son with Eva. But Dora did not wait for the threatened outburst.
"Hurry!" she cried. "You must do something! Paul has been wounded. Never mind how, but he lies in a fishing shack down at the cove, and they are going to arrest him. Locke is."
For the moment both men seemed to be stricken dumb, while Dora, in a state of wild excitement, pleaded for them to do something, anything to save the one person she loved. It was at this juncture that the door opened again, admitting another woman. It was Zita, very agitated, though, of course, under better control than Dora. Besides, Zita did not know what had happened to Paul, nor did she love him. It was merely that she felt that things could be made to play into her own hands if the news she brought were immediately acted upon. Hastily she told what she had overheard about the proposed receivership, and all four now, Balcom, Dr. Q, Dora, and Zita, talked excitedly. But it was plainly Balcom who was in command of the situation. Although livid with rage at the news he had heard, yet he maintained control of the others, directing what they should do with a decisiveness that was truly remarkable. It showed the mental force of the man, demonstrating how greatly he was to be feared by any bold enough to be his enemy. For Balcom loved that spoiled son of his, and would hesitate at no act, not even at a crime, to save him from even what he justly deserved. At last their plan was formed, and all four departed their several ways to execute it. Balcom had decided upon going directly to Brent Rock. His ire had not abated one iota during the trip, either, and as he almost ran up the steps to the mansion, he pushed the astounded butler to one side as though he were merely a piece of furniture.
"Tell Miss Brent I want to see her at once," he threatened.
The butler raised a hand deprecatingly at Balcom's tone, but Balcom, beside himself, smashed it down and strode toward the library, just as Eva, hearing the voices, was coming out. For an instant she drew back in apprehension and amazement as Balcom advanced on her, still snarling.
"See here, Eva," he hissed, "if Locke tries to arrest my son, he'll be killed."
For the instant Eva was stunned. What did the man mean? But as Balcom showed no signs of regaining control of himself, and every moment became more abusive and violent, indignation gave place to every other sentiment, and she sharply ordered Balcom to leave the house. Threatening dire things and hinting even more if there were a receivership, Balcom strode out. Eva stood for a long time shocked into inaction. Then, slowly, fears for Locke's safety came uppermost, and she paced back and forth the length of the hall. Finally, the old butler came to her deferentially.
"And did you notice, ma'am," he asked, "that during his tirade he mentioned about a cove fishing village? Might I suggest that that is where Mr. Paul is, and Mr. Locke will not be found far off?"
Eva thought a moment, recognized the sound sense of the remark, and ordered that her car be brought. A few moments later she had taken the wheel and was soon out of sight of Brent Rock. Close pressed against a wall of a back lane of the cove fishing village, Locke was standing, waiting for the men whom his chief had promised to send. Finally they came to him, first making their coming known to Locke by a peculiar low whistle.
"The other two will be along directly," whispered one of the pair. "Thought it better not to come in a bunch."
As Locke laid his plans, the other two came from out of the shadows. The entire party now moved cautiously toward old Tom's shack. Just before they arrived, one of the men said that he could see two figures entering the place. But as Locke had seen nothing, no attention was paid to the remark. Locke now placed one of his men on either side of the door. The other two he sent to the rear, so that they could surround the gang. He knocked at the door. This time it was immediately opened. Followed by the detectives, with revolvers drawn, Locke rushed boldly into the shack, while his other two men closed in from the rear. The emissaries, finding themselves surrounded, would have catapulted, probably without a struggle, had not the old hag, to whom no one had paid much attention, picked up a small anchor and thrown it at Locke and the advancing detectives. As it was, the anchor struck Locke a glancing blow, and he stumbled backward against one of his own men, upsetting him. That, of course, gave the advantage to the thugs, and they advanced, attacking savagely. It was at too close quarters, in the midst of such a melee, to use guns without danger of getting one of one's own party. Thus it was a primitive battle of brute force. Locke and the detectives were trained men, however, and were surely gaining the upper hand, so much so that Locke managed to tear himself loose and dash for the door leading to the attic. He opened it, and there, with revolver leveled at his head, stood Deluxe Dora. It was the work of only an instant to disarm her, however, and he rushed up the stairs, Dora after him. There was a body lying on the floor, Paul undoubtedly, thought Locke. He took it by the shoulder and turned it over, then fell back in amazement, for there, smiling mockingly at him, was Zita.
"You think you're pretty clever, don't you?"
jeered Dora. But it was no time to bandy words, and Locke left them and rushed down the stairs just as a horde of emissaries swarmed up to meet him, reinforcements to the fisher thugs. For in some way the automaton had been warned of Locke's presence, and with all the emissaries it could summon had hastened to old Tom's shack. Most unfortunate of all, the automaton and its men had arrived just behind the car bearing Eva, and she, not suspecting the danger, had entered the shack. Although she did not see Locke, she was overjoyed to see that the detectives held the upper hand. She had started to search for him, when there came a terrifying crash at the door, and more emissaries, followed by the automaton, came into the room. The detectives were almost instantly overpowered, and the mob made for the stairs just as Locke was descending. In that narrow space a most terrible battle took place. Man after man, Locke hurled against his fellows, and they went crashing down, only to rise again and attack. Finally they came to hand grips, and Locke, lunging furiously to free himself, threw his body against the partition of the stairway, and it came crashing down, hurling Locke and the emissaries to the floor below. Locke was badly stunned, and before he could rise, the emissaries had swathed him in the huge net that the old hag had been mending. Next they bound him with ropes until he was utterly helpless in the meshes of the net. Eva, half crazed with horror, was in a far corner, and the automaton was advancing upon her. She was paralyzed with fear. What fate was in store for her? What for Locke? End of chapter 21. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 22 of The Master Mystery. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Master Mystery by John W. Gray and Arthur B. Reeve. Chapter 22. The sharp crack of an automatic echoed through the shack. The detective known as Jim had come back to consciousness, and now, from behind an overturned table where he had fallen, he started to fire shot after shot into the mob of emissaries. He had fallen in a far corner and could be reached only after an attack of some paces, and even the emissaries, numerous as they were, hesitated to advance on a determined man placed in such an advantageous position. Furthermore, the diversion caused by the shots had other effects. The sound of the shots brought Locke fully out of his stunned condition, and he started to struggle frantically in the meshes of the net that held him prisoner. The automaton, for the moment, ceased to follow Eva, and moved over to its men in order to take command and to direct their movements, while yet another detective came to his senses and began to threaten the mob. Locke was threshing about and was slowly but surely freeing himself. An emissary threw a chair, and for a moment Locke lay still in pain. But in another moment he was working even more frantically at the ropes and the net that held him. Eva started over to help him, but he shouted to her to stand back, since that would bring her in line with the detective's fire. The shots were flying over Locke's body as he struggled. Some of the emissaries went down, others found places of refuge behind which they hid. Finally, Locke managed to kick his feet free of the net, and, rolling and tossing, managed to work the meshes up about his shoulders and neck, thus releasing his hands. It was the work of an instant only now to slip the enveloping net over his head, and he was free. Locke rolled out of the direction of the revolver shots and toward Eva, who was now standing before a huge open fireplace. He was none too soon, for the moment that the automaton saw that Locke had escaped the iron terror, left the men and stalked ponderously over to crush out Locke's life. The two detectives fired point-blank at the monster, and both shots took effect with a ringing, metallic sound. But they did not halt the automaton an instant. Locke, reaching the fireplace, seized a pair of old tongs and threw firebrand after firebrand in the path of the advancing terror. To the automaton, fire was evidently quite another affair from mere puny bullets, for it not only paused, but came to a full stop, looking around as though in a quandary as to what to do against such a defense. This moment of hesitation gave Locke and Eva their opportunity. Calling to the detectives to cease firing a moment, they passed between friends and foes, dashed over to and up the attic stairs. As they reached the attic above, they were just in time to see Zita, still dressed in Paul's clothes, and Dora jump from the attic window. Although it was a low, rambling building, still it was a high jump, even for a man, and Locke was astounded that they should attempt such a thing, even in their undoubted state of panic. However, it gave Locke a splendid idea, which he acted upon immediately. Hooking his feet on the window frame, he took hold of Eva's wrists firmly and swung her far out of the window. Held in this way, Eva was only a few feet from the ground, and when Locke released her, she landed safely and almost without a jar. For Locke, always in perfect training, the jump offered no difficulties. In an instant he had rejoined her, and they were running away from the shack toward Eva's waiting car. Locke had an almost overpowering desire to return to assist his detectives, whom he realized might be in sore straits, but he also realized that his first duty was to this girl who was in his charge, on whom the events through which they had just passed had had a nerve-racking effect. Again, he reflected, as he saw people coming down the beach, that the automaton and his men would soon be outnumbered and glad to flee. Quentin and Eva had almost reached the motor, which Eva had left at some distance from old Tom's shack, and were passing a low clump of bushes when a low moan fell upon their ears. At first, Locke thought that it might be a trap, and was for paying no attention to the sound, but Eva, womanlike, insisted. He investigated. Reclining on the ground and looking more like a little boy in man's clothes lay Zita. She was holding one ankle, and her face showed that she must be in great pain.
"Help me!" she moaned. "When I jumped from the window I sprained my ankle. Dora helped me to this place, and then she left me and drove away."
Although this girl was his enemy, no thought of leaving her in this condition entered Locke's mind. Gently raising her from the ground, with the help of Eva, Locke supported her to the car. Locke still held Zita to ease her pain, while Eva took the wheel, and although they could hear shouts and even shots behind them, Eva drove slowly in order not to add to Zita's misery. It showed the sympathy of their characters that, much as Locke and Eva felt that Zita had injured them, nevertheless, pausing in a flight from deadly peril, they found it in their hearts to be kind to an enemy. Arriving at Brent Rock, they carried Zita to her room, and the family physician was sent for. He pronounced the injury slight, and more of a strain than a sprain. While the doctor was at the house, he also paid a visit to Brent, who, while his mental condition had remained as apparently hopeless as ever, had gained much in strength, owing to the diet and restful care. He was now able to sit up, fully dressed. As it was a case of drug poisoning, the doctor had thought it best not to allow the patient to relax too completely. But whatever the strange drug that had stolen away Brent's reason, the effect showed no signs of departure, and they were as much in the dark as to the antidote as ever. A few moments after the doctor had left, when he made his morning call the next day, the council of the corporation was announced. He was shown into the library immediately, and it was there that Locke and Eva went into conference with him. The attorney had brought with him many shareholders' proxies, and these he handed over to Eva.
"These proxies," he was declaring, "give you absolute control, Miss Brent. With them you can force Mr. Balcom completely out of international patents."
"What's that you say?"
It was Balcom himself who spoke. How the man had got past the butler, who certainly had no love for him, was mystifying. Yet there he was, ready and eager to defend his interests.
"I was just telling Miss Brent," informed the lawyer, coldly, "that with these proxies which I have obtained and just handed to her, she was in complete control of the company."
"And you, Mr. Balcom," interposed Locke, stepping forward, "will play no further part in the activities of the company. Miss Brent desires your resignation to take effect immediately."
"Why, this is unheard of, absurd," sputtered Balcom. I'll
and his rage got the better of him.
"No, Mr. Balcom," again interrupted Locke, "you will do nothing. It is I who will give you 24 hours to arrange your affairs with the company before I order your removal or arrest."
Balcom tried to remonstrate, to plead his innocence of any wrongdoing. Finding no sympathy by taking this attitude, his manner changed abruptly, and he attempted to bluster. A decisive movement toward the telephone on the part of Locke checked this, and, chameleon-like, Balcom's usual suave manner came to the fore. He bowed himself out.
"It will, of course, be as you say."
He smiled oilily. Once in the hall, however, his manner changed again, and darkly scowling and biting his thin lips, he was about to quit the place, when Zita, limping only slightly, intercepted him.
"Mr. Balcom," she pleaded, "come out the back way. I must see you alone a moment."
They tiptoed out to the grounds, and behind a hedge where they could not be observed from the house, talked.
"Tell me what has happened,"
demanded Zita.
"Happened?" repeated Balcom. "Why, they've thrown me out of the company. At least they think they have."
His mind was working quickly, and after a pause he turned to Zita sharply.
"Can you get Brent out of the house and bring him to me here behind the hedge at 8 o'clock tonight?"
Zita nodded in eager acquiescence and left him, returning to the house. That evening Locke, returning from a stroll around the grounds, noticed a movement in some shrubbery at the side of the footpath. He went closer to investigate, and a rough-looking individual broke from cover and ran away through the underbrush as fast as he could go. It was too dark to follow, and Locke hastened his steps to the house, fearing some new deviltry on the part of the automaton or his emissaries. He had just entered the darkened hallway when, much to his surprise, he saw the figure of a man, leaning heavily on the arm of a woman, descending the stairs. He stepped behind some portières and waited until they reached the foot of the stairway. Then he stepped out and confronted them. Zita gave a startled cry and would have fled had not Locke caught and held her. As for poor Brent, he simply stood there, swaying from side to side and smiling foolishly. Eva heard the commotion and came running down the stairs. She was amazed until Locke explained the situation to her. Then her indignation knew no bounds. Putting her arms around her father, she turned to Zita.
"How dare you?" she demanded scathingly. "For doing this, you will leave this house immediately and never return."
Zita, for a moment, was on the verge of breaking down, but recovered herself, and with an angry retort on her lips, went out, slamming the door behind her. Zita slipped around the house and to the hedge designated by Balcom as their meeting place. She was surprised but relieved when she did not find him there, and glanced at her wristwatch, which stood at a few minutes past 8. She was about to turn around when she caught sight of a bit of paper. Taking it, she read,
"Bring him to my rooms."
That was all, and the message was unsigned. Zita greatly feared Balcom's wrath at her failure, but nevertheless she started for his apartment. At that moment Balcom and the mysterious Dr. Q were talking in the latter's dingy laboratory. Dr. Q's mind, for the time being at least, seemed perfectly clear, and he had formulated a daring plan.
"Send Locke word that you will give yourself up," he was saying, "but tell him that he must come to your apartment to get you. I will do the rest."
Balcom left hurriedly and was driven directly home, where he got Locke on the telephone and repeated the instructions that Dr. Q had suggested.
"Am I to understand that you intend to turn State's evidence?" questioned Locke doubtfully. "Assuredly," hastened Balcom. "Then I'll be right over."
As Balcom hung up the receiver, he chuckled sardonically. He was just turning to an antique brazier to arrange for Locke's reception when Zita was announced and at once admitted.
"I've failed, Mr. Balcom," she apologized. "Failed miserably. Locke took Mr. Brent away from me, and they ordered me never to return to the house."
"You little idiot," Balcom almost hissed. "I'll not tolerate a failure either. Get out."
Although Zita almost went on her knees in her pleading to him, Balcom was adamant, and finally she left in utter despair. Outside, she telephoned to Paul to see if she might induce him to use his influence in reinstating her in his father's good graces. As soon as Zita was gone, Balcom busied himself with the ancient brazier and was standing before a small image of Buddha.
He took a small package and from it poured a powder into a bowl of the brazier. Then, going to the table, he wrote a short note, after which he went to a divan and awaited Locke's coming. Balcom had not long to wait. A ring came at the door, and Balcom leaped to his feet and lighted the powder in the brazier. Then he adjusted a gas mask that Dr. Q had given him, and returning to the divan, lay down, pulling a camel's hair coverlet well over himself as he awaited results. There was a rap at the door, and a peremptory demand for entrance, a pause, and a whispered consultation outside.
"Open the door!" cried Locke again.
As there was no answer, heavy blows were rained upon the door, and finally it gave way. Three men stumbled into the room. They stared about, then started to search the place. One by one they started to cough. Locke, who was the farthest away from the brazier, seemed to be the least affected. Finally he spied the note on the table and snatched it up. By the dim light he read,
"You will never live to capture me. The deadly gas is even now killing you."
Locke gasped. There was the sound of a heavy fall behind him. He turned and saw that one of his men was down. He took a step forward, when the other pitched on his face. Locke tried to rescue them, but by this time the deadly fumes had reached him, and he, too, fell to the floor, coughing his life away. At that moment Balcom got up from the divan, and, stepping over Locke's prostrate body, left the place, forgetting to close the door behind him. When Zita telephoned Paul, Paul made an immediate appointment for her to meet him at Dr. Q's, and when she arrived there, Paul was already in conference with the doctor. Over the telephone, Zita had already given Paul a brief account of what had happened, and thus the two men were prepared with a plan when she arrived.
"Get Eva to the hypnotist's on River Street," instructed Dr. Q. "Tell her that I have been hypnotized, and that under the spell I will tell all."
It was a desperate thing for Zita to attempt, after treating the Brent so shamelessly, but there was no alternative, for she knew well that with Balcom only a success would offset her miserable failure earlier in the evening. Besides, were not her fortunes tied up with Balcom, or perhaps with Paul? She did not demur, but left immediately for Brent Rock to make the attempt, revolving in her mind how she was to do it. Zita had difficulty in persuading Eva to see her at all, but once she had succeeded, the possibility that all the mystery might be cleared up appealed strongly to Eva. For Zita had framed her story cleverly and was playing desperately.
"Then I'll meet you at the hypnotist's in about half an hour," agreed Eva, after Zita had told her how friendless she herself was, and how both Balcom and Paul had refused her aid.
Zita left Brent Rock alone, and was passing a dark corner, when a hand reached out and grasped her by the arm, and she heard a voice that she recognized.
"Your failure has made me redouble my efforts," it hissed. "I have just killed Locke in my apartment, and I—"
It was Balcom, but Zita waited to hear no more. Secretly she had always loved Locke. Though she had worked against him, the very thought that he might be dead shocked her. She tore herself from the grasp of Balcom before she could hear more, and ran like a deer toward the apartment. Fortunately it was not far. She tore upstairs and through the door that Balcom had left open. Everything was as Balcom had left it, except that now the three men lay quite still. Zita staggered over to a window and threw it open. Next, she got water and extinguished the still smoldering powder. Then, falling on her knees, she tried to help the stricken men. Not much time did she spend with the others, but to Locke, with great tenderness, she gave most of her attention. Tenderly she bathed his brow and frantically tried even to breathe her breath into his burning lungs. Finally she was rewarded by seeing him open his eyes and gaze around. He looked up at her.
"I'll atone for all the wrong I've done," she sobbed. "Only—"
She would have asked him to love her, but she knew that it was useless, and the thought of Eva caused the words to stick in her throat. Locke did not understand, and the look on his face showed it.
"I didn't want to give you up,"
wailed Zita, now forgetting herself.
"I loved you. To prove it, I will help you now. The girl you love is in terrible danger. You must hurry."
It was only too true. Eva had driven immediately to the hypnotist's, and he had been instructed about her coming. At his door she had knocked, and an old, evil-visaged man, in flowing robes which were marked in cabalistic signs, had opened the door. In true fakir fashion, he salaamed almost to the floor while in flowery language he bade her enter. Fearfully Eva stepped within. Signs of the zodiac, of crossbones and skulls, on walls and ceiling, met her gaze everywhere. In an alcove Eva could see a noosed rope hanging, for what purpose she knew not, but its presence she felt was sinister.
I was told that a Dr. Q would be here," Eva faltered. "I do not see him."
"Gracious lady," bowed the hypnotist, "I will bring him at once. Pray be seated."
Eva seated herself before a table upon which there stood a curious stand supporting many mirrors. She examined it closely, and as she did so they all began to move. Each mirror moved on its own axis, and she watched with fatal curiosity. For now a bright light was cast from behind her on the revolving mirrors, and they formed a scintillating kaleidoscope that was bewildering in its intricacy. Eva quickly became fascinated. Then she was conscious of a drowsy feeling stealing over her. She strove to rise, but her knees refused to support her, and she fell back in her chair. The hypnotist now shut off the machine, and stepping before Eva, made several passes with his hands. Eva's eyes closed. The hypnotist turned and made a signal. Several panels opened simultaneously, and into the room there came a number of emissaries, who crept upon the now completely hypnotized girl. Nor was that all. A sound, as of the clanking of chains, was heard, and through an aperture in the wall larger than the others there stalked the automaton. At this very instant Locke and Zita burst into the room and rushed toward Eva. The hypnotist slipped around them both, and in a moment had caught Zita in his arms. She struggled to escape, beating him with her little fists in a fury of rage and fear. But he held her, and an emissary bringing ropes, with his help, bound her securely. As for Locke, he made a frantic attempt to reach Eva, but his way was blocked by a score of emissaries and the automaton himself. Desperately Locke dashed at the iron monster, only to be hurled to the floor as though he were a tiny child. In another moment the emissaries had bound him and carried him to the alcove in which hung the noosed rope. The hypnotist now pulled a lever, and the method of the death intended for Locke was revealed. Directly under the suspended rope was a trap door, which opened. Locke gazed down into blackness, nothingness. An emissary threw some small, heavy object into the yawning hole. For a long time nothing was heard. Then, finally, far, far below, there came to their ears the sound of a distant splash. The fiendish plan was simple: to hang him, and then to cut the rope. His body would go hurtling down to the subterranean river below and be carried out to sea. The hypnotist reversed the lever. The trapdoor closed. Locke was dragged beneath the rope, and it was adjusted around his neck. Even in this awful moment his sole thought was of Eva. Would they throw her, unconscious, down the same yawning trap? Powerless, he stood bound, fascinated, as he saw three emissaries seize her. But instead of dragging her to the trap, they dragged her toward one of the panels in the wall. What nameless torture was in store for her? He struggled furiously to get free, to rush to her, but the noose only tightened on his neck. The hypnotist stepped to the lever that operated the trap under Locke's feet and began to pull the lever down. End of chapter 22. Recording by Roger Moline.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.